Hello and welcome into this Thursday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Mark Congleton here, your occasionally humble host, for this hour of observation, insight, and absurdity. Hoping that you are coping well and that you and yours are fine. A happy Thursday to you. It is the ninth day of April 2020, and we are back to quasi-normal. Nothing outside tugging me away, so everything should be fine today. It's funny. I scrambled and got everything done yesterday before I had to leave for my outside studio session, and on the way, I pulled out my phone and pulled up podcasts, and yesterday's podcast was not there, even though everything on my computer said, okay, you're good to go. See ya. No podcast was there. So I had to wait until I got home. And when I got back into the studio again, I got back into the computer and looked at it. And it very clearly, the way it works is it shows you the IP address of the actual audio file on this audio server at the podcast hosting service. It shows you exactly where it's a web address. And so that link is there. You see the link is there. Okay, good. It's there. And you tell it to publish, and you click on the publish thing, and you acknowledge, yes, I want to publish it now. I've got to go. And you click on publish, and then it shows you the page, and everything is peachy, I should say. It's just everything is peachy. And I left thinking everything was peachy, but it weren't so much peachy. It weren't. It was more Brussels sprouty. It was not good. Let's just say that. So, and I couldn't turn around and fix it because I was going to be at the Dawson Now studio like 10 minutes before we were supposed to start recording. And I knew that everybody would be nervous, but I wasn't nervous because I knew what we were doing, and I knew that nothing had changed in the setup, and nothing had been, unless somebody moved things around and disconnected things and reconnected things, then everything was going to be fine because we have put everything together to work a certain way. And there is that possibility that somebody decides to redecorate, but no, everything is cool. So I'm in the elevator on the way up to the floor where the studio is, and I get a text. Are we going to be good to go? I texted back, I'm on my way up. And everything went well. We had two recordings yesterday. Very interesting sessions with interesting people about marriage and family. And, well, marriage and family and anxiety. And I'll tell you something, that a lot of people today are anxious. They're anxious because of what they're being told. They're having all of this information thrown at them every day about the coronavirus, about COVID-19, about death and mayhem. And it's they're seeing a lot of stuff that, I'll just be honest with you, they're seeing a lot of stuff on the news. It's just not so. They're being told many, many things that are just not quite right. And this is something that it's frightening people. And I've dealt with this before. I think it's aberrant. I think it's disgusting. I think it's nasty. I think it's evil that politicians, okay, leftist politicians predominantly thrive on fear. They want people to be afraid because they want to be the hero. And so what's happening right now is that people in America and around the world are scared, and they're turning to government for help. And this is making some people in government very happy. And our president, Donald Trump, has actually said so from the podium during his daily briefings that, hey, this is not what the federal government's here for. That's your state and local government. They're here. That's why they are there. We're the federal government. And he said that, I saw that one time when he said that to some reporter, we're the federal government. The federal government, as in, you understand this, right? You went to school and were taught this, right? The federal government is not here to take care of you in your state. That's what your state and local government's for. They're they are supposed to coordinate and handle situations like this, and the federal government is here as a backup to help the states get along together, to help, for instance, two adjoining states have different policies about travel and about public exposure, about as far as, you know, isolation and the like. I shouldn't have said isolation. Public exposure sounds like something you get busted for. But they have two different policies about it, and one governor is saying, well, that governor over there is crazy, and the other governor is saying, well, that governor over there is nuts, but I tell you what, this is what we're going to do, but they're different. Well, the federal government comes into play as people have to deal with these two states. One state has to deal with another, people traveling back and forth for needs. One state sees it's not a valid or essential need. The other state sees it as an essential need. And the federal government is there to say, hey, play nice. Here's what you should do. That's in a nutshell, an oversimplified, very oversimplified explanation of why they're there. So he says to them, we're the federal government. We're the federal government. You understand that, right? You're the federal government. We're here as a backup. And he was absolutely right. The sad thing is, and my wife Jane and I have been talking about this a lot lately, is that they don't teach this to our kids in school anymore. They don't understand that the federal government is not there to take care of the state's needs. The state government is supposed to handle a lot of stuff. You elect people to represent you, to do certain things, to make sure your state is run properly, because we are the United States. There are 50 of them. Go count them one day. There are 50 of them plus territories. But we are the United States. Each state governs itself. Each state looks to the federal government for guidance and direction as to dealing with each other and to provide certain things for national defense and the like. But we are a nation of states, not a nation state. And sadly, kids today, and when I say kids, I may as well include all of the talking heads on the leftist news media. These people all seem to believe that we're one big state and that the federal government is supposed to be there to take care of everything for all of us. And that is not true. It's not so. It's not the way this nation is set up. It's not the way it operates. But politicians on the left are now using terminology and convincing people that that is the way things are. It's not supposed to be that way at all. So that's just something to remember. We have different situations in different states, different needs, different people, different guidelines, different rules. Things are different everywhere. You may be in Hawaii. Your government has things set up differently than Alabama does. Why? Your needs are vastly different. You're an island. You're a state that's a set of islands, actually. Everything that comes to you comes from somewhere else unless it's grown there or constructed there. And if it's constructed there, chances are parts that it's made of came from elsewhere. Things are different. In Alabama, you can grow the trees, you can cut the trees, you can do all this other stuff, you can build everything. There are automotive plants, there are all kinds of things in Alabama. Alabama literally could be a self-sustaining place with no other needs from anywhere. Except possibly if you want seafood, and then you work out a deal with Florida, and you import seafood. But the thing is that the needs are different. The people's needs are different. The lifestyles are different. So having one centralized government is not just inefficient, it's stupid. But that's what the progressives want. They want us to have this one. Actually, what the progressives want is that on a global scale. And that becomes even more stupid. Because the differences between people in geographic regions on one continent don't even compare to the differences of the needs and the habits and the lifestyles and the traditions and everything else, the cultures of the people worldwide. We're not one world. Paul Harvey used to say that a lot. We're not one world. We are not, even though humanity is very much the same, we are very different because of our cultures. We're very different. We have different views on life. We have different needs because of our cultural differences. We should celebrate those cultural differences and at the same time remember they're different. So we can't all come be governed from the same place. But the progressives want that. They want a singular world effort. Someone at the UN there was a man from either the UN or the formerly with the WHO, and he's slipping my mind right now, and I apologize. I can see his face. I looked at the article. I just don't remember the guy's name or the organization, but he was saying we need a united worldwide governance over handling the coronavirus. That is a massively idiotic idea because the needs of every nation and subsections of each of those nations, they're all wildly different. They're all very, very different. Just look at the United States for one example. There are some places that have very, very few cases of coronavirus. Some places with very few casualties from the disease. Other places, they're covered up with it. Why? Lifestyles are different in those different places. Population density is different in those different places. The actual needs of the people are different in those different places. So a centralized government is a bad idea. A centralized control of medical care is a bad idea because the needs are different everywhere. And every time some government wonk decides to bring everything under one umbrella, Obamacare is a good example. When they bring that under one umbrella, they always leave things out that affect people with specific needs, and they always put things in that affect everyone who doesn't have certain needs. So people are required to buy certain levels of insurance, which they have no need for, and others buy the insurance but can't get the coverage they need. And that's why a centralized plan doesn't work. There has to be much more flexibility. But government wonks don't think that way. Everything is theory to them. Everything is, this is the way things should be. And they look at things through the lens of possibility, not reality. Because the vast majority of them have never actually held a job or managed payroll or run a business in the real world. They've never had to deal with people on a real level. They've never been in business. And now we have a president who has spent his life in the business world, and he's looking at government and running it like a business. And all of the politicians who've never been in the real world and worked in the real world are freaking out. And those on the left are taking advantage of that freak out and trying to destroy the man who's trying to correct all the problems. Wow, have I wandered all over the place. How are you doing? You okay? How was your day yesterday? Mine was kind of busy, but if everything's okay now. Oh, man. Excuse me for hopping up on the soapbox right away. But life in the United States is different across the nation. People in New York City have different needs than people in rural New York. People in rural New York have different needs than people in rural Alabama. People in rural Alabama have different needs than people in Hawaii. People in Los Angeles have different views about things than everybody else in the country. And people in central flyover country, in the heartland of America, have different needs than people everywhere else. You can't use a one-size-fits-all solution for things like we're looking at today. You just can't. But that's all I needed to say about that, I guess. I talked myself all the way to the break. I'm not sure if I made any sense. Oh, my goodness. still to come. Bernie Sanders has dropped out of the presidential race. And we'll see how that affected a handful of things. The CDC has issued some new guidance on working and isolation. We'll take a look at that. You may end up getting a payroll tax cut as a result of all this stuff. That would be interesting. And hopefully we'll have time to get to it. But we'll need to ask the question at some point, how would President Obama have handled the coronavirus response? We'll get started after the break as the Daily Perspective continues. Welcome back to the Daily Perspective. It's the Thursday, April 9th edition of the podcast. It's good to have you along today. I really do appreciate you being there. Hope you're doing well. Hope you and yours are fine. Yesterday, as I said, was an interesting day. And it was one of those, and I know you have these days too, where it hits a certain point in the day and you stop for a moment and wonder, how did I get here? Wow. It was that kind of day yesterday. It was that kind of day where I was just busy. And at some point when my wife got home and she's disgusted by something. What was it? Oh, yeah, because I hadn't let the dog out in a while. It had been quite some time since I let the dog out. And I sat there thinking, now, how did all that time go by? And I didn't even think about letting Kimber out. How did that happen? And it was because I had spent a great little time. Once I got back to the studio, I got busy. I'm working on a video project, and I mentioned that before. I'm working on this video project, and my poor little MacBook Pro, it's 8 years old, and I'm asking way more of it than it can handle, and it's just like, I love Macs, but as the software gets newer and newer and more powerful, the older computers just can't handle them anymore, and they finally just throw their hands in the air and say, "Ah, I'm out of here." And so that's kind of what happened yesterday. Was that it was just a bizarre day. And so I was trying to deal with things, trying to manage the way it was handling the video situation, and it just didn't work. I lost a lot of time yesterday working on that, and then I turned around and focused on prep for today and for this, and the next thing I know, my wife is home. And she's wondering why the dog hadn't been out since 11 in the morning. So that's just, anyway, that was my day yesterday. Okay, let's see here. Where do we go? Bernie Sanders is out. He's dropped out of the 2020 bid for president. He ended his presidential bid yesterday. That makes Joe Biden the presumptive Democrat nominee to challenge President Donald Trump in the general election campaign that'll be waged against the backdrop of the coronavirus pandemic. Sanders initially exceeded sky-high expectations about his ability to recreate the magic of his 2016 presidential bid, but he even overcame a heart attack last October. A lot of people don't remember that. Remember, Bernie had a heart attack back in October, but he couldn't convert unwavering support from progressives into a viable path to the nomination. With electability fears fueled by questions about whether his democratic socialist ideology would be palatable to general election voters. Sanders told his supporters yesterday, "The path toward victory is virtually impossible. If I believed we had a feasible path to the nomination, I would certainly continue the campaign, but it's just not there." He called Biden a very decent man, but didn't offer an explicit endorsement of the former VP. Sanders said his name would remain on the ballot in states that have not yet held primaries so he can gain more delegates and exert significant influence on the Democratic Party platform. It's interesting that he refers to Biden as a very decent man. Have you noticed that everybody on the left is ignoring the sexual abuse claims that have been raised against Joe Biden? Everybody, the news media, the politicians, they're all ignoring it. Everybody's ignoring it. What happened to the Me Too movement? Alyssa Milano and this was bizarre, weird, strange, but very telling. She even said, he needs due process in this. She was unwilling to give Brett Kavanaugh due process. She's unwilling to give Donald Trump due process. But Joe Biden, due process. She also urged Bernie Sanders, for the love of God, please get out of the race. Interesting. Biden, he's backed by much of the party's establishment, told supporters at a virtual fundraiser he had a short conversation with Sanders Wednesday. He said he didn't just run a political campaign, he created a movement. That's a good thing for our nation and our future. His campaign has ended, but I know his leadership will continue. Interesting. Now, President Trump took advantage of the situation by tweeting Wednesday that the party stacked the race against Sanders. The president said the senator's supporters should come to the Republican Party. And he's absolutely right. They once again used Bernie Sanders to stir things up and then stacked everything against him, just like they did with Hillary. Just like they did with Hillary. Well, response has been interesting. I would say that probably most Bernie supporters have been shell-shocked. They're unhappy. They have lots of conspiracy theories to talk about and the like, but I'm sorry. I'm distracted because I just opened the next story, and in all this time, it's been absolutely fine, and now it's covering the screen. But the reaction from some has been optimistic. The potential reopening of the economy is not only the only fresh prospect easing the stock market tensions now that the Bernie revolution has officially halted. Stocks are surging upwards as investors warm to the fact that a socialist will not be occupying the White House next February. Yeah. Shortly after Bernie dropped out of the race, positive dividends started popping up in the stock market. The Dow gained 700 points. Wait, Bernie's out? Woohoo! Fox Business says U.S. equity markets rallied to session highs on Wednesday after Senator Sanders announced he was suspending his presidential campaign. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 593 points, or 2.62%, ahead of the noon hour, while the S&P 500 and NASDAQ Composite rose 2.4% and 204% respectively. The gains have lifted the S&P 500 out of its bear market, which would officially end with the index closing above 2684.88. Ed Mills, Washington policy strategist at Raymond James, told CNBC that Sanders' exit has eased tensions over the economic fallout from some of his policy proposals. Sanders' exit removes the tail risk of some of his policies, immediately sets up focus on Biden versus Trump, said Mills. Biden's policies will get a new scrutiny now that he's the presumptive nominee, but the truth of the matter is that the market will be looking towards Washington more to help the economy, and much of the assistance matches his platform. In other good news, the stock market began to take a positive turn this week as Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, expressed more optimism about the coronavirus and its bending curve. Jim Paulson, chief investment strategist at the Luthold Group, said, if the curve is bending for the first time, some timeline is coming into focus for restarting at least parts of the economy. This means investors can start to reduce their best guesses as to how long this recession will last, and even if the recession is very deep. If its duration can be shortened and known with some greater clarity, this would tend to raise the value of the stock market. As reported by Amanda Prestigiacomo. That's a great name, Amanda, over at the Daily Wire. The White House updated its coronavirus projection models yesterday, lowering the death count and hospitalizations by steady margins from 93,531 deaths to 81,766 deaths to 60,415 deaths. Moreover, the projected total hospital bed shortage decreased, and the so-called peak of hospital usage was pushed up from April 15th to April 11th. The peak daily death toll was also moved up to April 12th from the revised April 16th date. Addressing his supporters on Wednesday, Bernie Sanders, a twice-failed presidential campaign, did say that he won the ideological battle against Joe Biden. However,
how we won this?
Yeah, sure you did. He said, "Together we have transformed the American consciousness as to what kind of nation we can become. Our movement has won the ideological struggle." Joe Biden, whose son earned an estimated $50,000 per month working on the board of the Ukrainian energy company Burisma without any prior experience, was regarded by Bernie Sanders as a decent man. So what that tells me is that Bernie Sanders is just as corrupt as all of the rest of them, which shouldn't come as no surprise to anyone who recognizes socialism for what it actually is. It's a giant scam. It puts a handful of people, elites, in power over everyone else. Elites who believe they are intellectually and morally superior to the rest of the world. Elites who believe the little people are too stupid to understand, so they must be shepherded. Elites who will still have all the benefits of a decent salary, good food, good places to live, nice vehicles, multiple homes, I might add, in the case of Bernie Sanders, the millionaire socialist, but whose adoring followers will believe the lie and willingly sacrifice all of their comfort, all of their security, all of their freedom, just so they can feel better about things. And make no mistake about it, Joe Biden is beating the same drum.
Now you're talking like a man.
Well, thank you. Welcome back to the Daily Perspective. Good to have you along today. Well, Bernie Sanders has dropped out. The stock market is responding positively. It's also responding to the fact that the CDC has recalculated some things, made some changes. And I think we need to remember that all of these worst-case scenarios that we were pitched in the beginning were worst-case scenarios. I remember at one point I was looking at, where was it? It was worldometer.com. Looking at the numbers of deaths worldwide and look at the cases worldwide, the deaths worldwide, and then looking at the United States, the number of cases and the number of deaths and the projections. They were talking about 100 to 250,000 people dying, and they had an end date somewhere in the middle of April, end of April, something like that we were going to peak at this number. And I was looking at it thinking, we've had, at that time, I think it was something like 11,000 or so deaths, and I thought, man, a lot of people are going to die. I mean, a lot of people are going to die in the next few weeks in order to make this pass. There's no way that can happen. Well, the reason there's no way that can happen is because they use all of these models. They model things on data that's given to them, and a lot of that data is speculative. It's just speculation. The models are speculation. This is why the whole global warming / man-made climate change stuff is all just, it's just tissue paper. You can tear right through it because it's all based on models, which are based on previous models, which are based on bad information, which are based on speculation. And they can come back at you with reams of data and say, well, the data proves everything. Well, the data's built on a pile of sand. It can't stand when under close scrutiny. And the same is holding true for this whole coronavirus thing. And it's looking like the projections now, and these are the high-end projections now, are well within the margin of what the regular influenza deaths are like every year. Now, please don't get me wrong. The deaths are tragic. It's bad. It's not a good thing. But it's not any different than the flu would have been. So, or probably less than the flu. And that's something I've kept talking about. Yeah, it's wrong. When people pass away, when people die of something, it's wrong. Especially something that could have been prevented had we had the heads up from China earlier. But these projections are changing now. The way things are looking is changing now. And as a result, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, announced new coronavirus guidance yesterday, saying some essential workers who have been exposed to COVID-19 but are not showing symptoms can return to work. Each worker would need to take his or her temperature twice a day for signs of a fever and wear a face mask at work and out in public to prevent the spread of the virus. That's according to Dr. Robert Redfield, the director of the CDC. He said that at yesterday's White House coronavirus briefing. A couple of things real quick. My wife and I found face masks. We ordered a couple of face masks. Just highway robbery expensive. It was ridiculous. But we thought, you know what? There's going to come a time when we're going to have to get into something and go someplace and really mix with a lot of people. And she deals with the public every day. So I said, I'm ordering face masks. They arrived yesterday. They'll fit her. They won't fit me. They're so small. I was just amazed. Oh, well, anyway, so I found another source. And those are coming as well. Hopefully, one of those will fit me. Because I'd rather wear one of the medical face masks than I have other options. But if I wear one of these face shields that I wear when I'm working outdoors in the pollen and stuff like that, if I wear one of those, and people wear them for hunting too, to keep their face warm and the like. If it's not one of those big things you pull over your head, it hangs around your neck, keeps your neck warm, and then you can pull it up over your nose and mouth. But wear one of those, a baseball cap and sunglasses, and walk into the Dollar General. I'll be having a talk with the sheriff's department before long. Let's just say that. Okay. Anyway. Oh, man. Redfield said the guidance was an effort to really begin to get these critical workers back into the workforce so we won't have to have worker shortages in the critical industries. That's including first responders, healthcare workers, food supply workers, and more. The CDC was also encouraging employers to take their employees' temperatures at the beginning of the workday and send home anybody who showed symptoms. In addition, officials said buildings should increase their air exchange and increase the frequency of how they clean common rooms and areas. Employees still have been discouraged from congregating in break rooms, lunch rooms, or any large gathering spaces. The new considerations by the CDC signal the slightest hope for return to normalcy in the U.S., even as the death toll reached 13,929 and the country continues to grapple with 404,532 cases of the virus. And when I look at my sources, that number, let's see, it's 435,167 now, 14,797 deaths. And then there's the number nobody talks about, 22,897 people have recovered. So that's good news. The CDC is giving us a little bit of hope, and that's because things are changing, and they are changing for the better. The worst case scenarios are not playing out. The CDC also is considering changing the guidelines for self-isolation to make it easier for folks who've been exposed to someone with the coronavirus to go back to work if they're asymptomatic. The Public Health Agency, in conjunction with the White House Coronavirus Task Force, is considering an announcement as well, they did it yesterday, in fact. So these guidelines for the covering both sides of this issue were announced yesterday. And the, where is this? There was something in this article. The proposed guidance would follow recommendations made by the CDC that ease self-isolation requirements for frontline medical workers who were exposed to the virus. Under CDC guidance, medical workers who have been exposed to the virus without protective equipment but who have no symptoms can return to work with a mask and temperature checks after 14 days. So after your isolation for 14 days, you've got a mask, you wear your mask, and they check your temperature. They make sure that you are not stepping into that zone where you could actually be contagious. And that's what they're looking for. You know, if you've dealt with the flu or something like that, you go get treatment, your temperature starts dropping, and when it gets back around normal again, then they say, okay, well, you're no longer contagious. You should be fine. And that's what they're looking at with this as well. Mike Pence said that some of the best minds at the White House are beginning to think about what recommendations will look like that we give to businesses, that we give to states, but it will all, I promise you, be informed on putting the health and well-being of the American people first. And that is the most important thing. And as I said a while ago, we're looking at this situation on a daily basis, and I keep three tabs on my browser open. Three tabs. And one of them deals with the number of flu deaths, seasonal flu deaths, this year. And this is worldwide, 132,311 flu deaths worldwide this year. So far, around the world, coronavirus, 81,691. And we're entering into that time right now when the flu cases start dropping off. It's the time of the year where the flu is starting to run its course. And we're starting to see the same thing happen with the coronavirus. And there are a handful of environmental, I say environmental, but just seasonal causes, reasons for this. And there's also the self-isolation we've been going through. They say that's been helpful. Although there's some places who haven't done this, where they seem to have similar results. But good news all around. So let's all be hopeful, shall we? That things will be getting better, that they'll be easing restrictions, that things will be, as far as the stats of total cases and the total new deaths and things like that that are popping up in the charts, let's be hopeful that those are all on the downward trend. And it seems to be that they are. It seems to be that they are. I'm looking at the charts right now, and state by state across the United States, let me refresh this, shall I? You mind? Can I do it? Can I just refresh it for a second? Here, click the refresh button, and it's refreshing. Here we go. I'm looking at new cases, new coronavirus cases. And I'm looking down the charts to see state by state. I'm looking at all the states and the territories. Okay. A total in the last 24 hours of 240 new cases in the last 24 hours. 7 in Guam, 233 in California. The only column in this with new deaths, 9 new deaths in the state of California. That's the only column in the United States of America. And this chart had these, by the way, the death blocks are always red. This chart in the last couple of weeks has had lots of red in it. And today, one red block. So that's looking good. Now we look back at yesterday. This is bound to change. Yesterday, 1,940 new deaths yesterday. By the end of today, we'll see. Right now, as of 8:43 a.m. Central Time, only 9 today. Let's look back at new cases yesterday. Yeah, every column, every one of them's got something in it. There were over 31,000 new cases yesterday. As of right now, so far, 240. So things are looking better. We'll see by the end of the day how it actually pans out, but the number recovered, that's also important. It's very important. Let me look over here and see I'm looking to see if there is a column. Actually, there's no column for the number recovered. That's interesting. Hey, worldometers, why, or worldometers, why is there not a recovered column? Huh. Interesting. That's interesting. They have one listing for all. They have all the states. They have the regions. They have the military. They have people who have come back from Wuhan. And they have a line for the Diamond Princess Cruise line. 46 cases there. Active cases. But there is not a listing. I'm looking here. Total cases, new cases, death, new deaths, active cases, total cases per million, death per million, total tests per million, but nothing for recoveries. As I said, that number is very important. As of right now, 22,897 recovered cases. And those are counted among people who have been tested. We know they've had it. Imagine how many more there are. We've talked about that before, too. Everybody who got a little sick and then got over it, and they probably had the coronavirus but don't have it now.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Ooh. Welcome back to the Daily Perspective. It's the Thursday edition of the podcast, and we're about to wrap things up here, diving into the final segment of the day. I have this little quirk that where I actually do that word. It's like word by word, the final segment of the day, and it hits me every now and then. There's a guy whose podcast, whose vidcast, his vlog, I stop watching because he talks that way. It drives me nuts, and I do the same thing. He's like, come on, speak a sentence. Well, let's take a look at how things would have been handled differently 10 years ago. As Congress battles over the makeup of the phase 4 coronavirus, the president, we're going to look at that in a couple of minutes, but first up, the president's looking at a tax cut, a payroll tax cut. He says, we're looking at a payroll tax cut. That would be almost immediate. It would be a little bit of an extended period. It's a good thing. It would be very quick. Hopefully, during this new infrastructure plan, the thing that they're working on, he can succeed in doing that, because that would be very helpful to you and me. That would mean that we'd be keeping more of our money every pay period. I've seen some who have posted, hey, why don't you just give us, just waive our taxes? Let us not pay the federal taxes for a year. Why not? How about federal, state, and state taxes, local tax? Why don't we just waive that for the time being, to help everybody out, to have more operating cash? That would give people thousands of dollars, not just $1,200 a person. Oh, they're not going to give that up. Trust me. They're not going to give that up. Great idea, but they're not going to give that up. Well, according to a new Politico Morning Consult poll released yesterday, a majority of registered voters believe former President Obama would do a better job at handling the coronavirus pandemic than President Trump. According to the poll, 52% of the survey's 1,990 respondents said they believed that Obama would be a better leader than Trump during the ongoing pandemic, compared to the 38% who said they thought Trump is the better leader. Considering the lengths that the mainstream media has gone to criticize Trump's response to the coronavirus, even blaming him for the death of the man who drank poisonous fish tank cleaner because it had chloroquine phosphate in it. By the way, that's very fishy. There are some who are saying his wife may have killed him with it. It's almost shocking. Trump does as well as 38% in the poll. Obama, however, received overwhelmingly glowing coverage during the H1N1 pandemic of 2009. The results of this poll are a reflection of a dishonest media that has tasked itself with trying to prevent Trump's re-election in November through their biased coverage of the pandemic. President Trump's response to the coronavirus may not be perfect. No pandemic response can be. But make no mistake about it, Obama would have seriously botched the coronavirus pandemic. And here are six solid reasons why. Number six, Obama failed to restock the strategic national stockpile after H1N1. His failures during the H1N1 pandemic had consequences for the current coronavirus pandemic, because in 2009, the Obama administration depleted the strategic national stockpile of N95 respirators and never replenished the stockpile during the remainder of his presidency. According to the LA Times, after the swine flu epidemic in 2009, a Safety Equipment Industry Association and a federally sponsored task force both recommended that the depleted supplies of N95 respirator masks be replenished by the stockpile. The problem is it didn't happen. According to Charles Johnson, the president of the International Safety Equipment Association, about 100 million N95 respirator masks were used up during the swine flu pandemic of 2009-2010, but he said he was unaware of any major effort to restore the stockpile to cover that drawdown. In fact, the Obama administration ignored at least three government reports in which federal officials predicted the United States would experience a critical lack of ventilators during a global pandemic. If Obama couldn't be bothered to replenish the strategic national stockpile after depleting it in the first place and then ignoring multiple warnings about it, how exactly does that translate into Obama would do a better job with the coronavirus? Number five, Barack Obama's Department of Health and Human Services declared the H1N1 pandemic a national health emergency on April 29, 2009, but didn't declare it a national emergency until October. That's 2 months after the World Health Organization declared it a pandemic. 2 months! 1,000 Americans had already died due to the H1N1 virus at that point. It can't be a coincidence that Obama finally declared H1N1 a national emergency just days before a congressional oversight panel slammed his administration's response to the pandemic as inadequate and complete. Number four, Obama didn't implement any travel bans during H1N1. The H1N1 outbreak originated in Mexico. Despite calls from members of Congress to do so, the Obama administration refused to restrict travel with Mexico or close the border. Obama's DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano said, "Closing our nation's borders is not merited here." She argued that closing the border or U.S. ports would have no impact or very little in stopping or slowing the spread of the virus. Trump proved this theory wrong when he took the bold step of banning travel from China back in January, got criticized for it, called a racist. But a month later, the WHO experts conceded it worked and it saved lives. Number three, Obama's H1N1 pandemic response was plagued by vaccine shortages. What? In addition to being ill-prepared, the Obama administration failed to achieve its vaccine production goals. The New York Times reported in January of 2010 that the Obama administration predicted in early summer of 2009 that it would have 160 million vaccine doses by late October. It ended up with less than 30 million. That led to a public outcry and congressional investigations. It was a failure that undoubtedly cost lives. Number two. You might want to sit down for this one. Put your seatbelt on, especially if you are a progressive. Obama cut funding to the NIH. Remember, Democrats like Joe Biden claimed Trump cut funding to the CDC and the NIH. It was a lie. Who actually did cut funding? Barack Obama. Analysis from the Cato Institute found that real NIH spending soared from the mid-1990s to 2011. It was then cut under President Obama, but has rebounded under President Trump. Real CDC spending soared from around 1990 to 2010, but has been roughly flat since then. As for the CDC, Trump has been criticized for requesting cuts, but the Obama administration did as well. I talked about this not too long ago. And some of those cuts sought by Obama specifically took aim at the CDC's preparedness initiatives, so they could not be prepared for an oncoming pandemic. And finally, number one, Obama actually did dissolve the White House Pandemic Office in 2009. It wasn't all that long ago that the media falsely blamed Trump for dissolving the White House Pandemic Response Office in 2018. The claim was quickly debunked. But here's something you probably didn't hear about. Barack Obama actually did eliminate the White House Pandemic Response Office in 2009, the same year as the H1N1 pandemic. In fact, there was no dedicated anti-pandemic unit at the White House National Security Council until one was created in the final months of the Obama administration, 7 years after the H1N1 pandemic started, 2 years after the Ebola pandemic or epidemic. Barack Obama's response to the H1N1 pandemic was slow. It was plagued by vaccine shortages. His response to the 2014 Ebola outbreak was also plagued with problems, which apparently convinced him to reopen the office 2 years later. Everything about the H1N1 pandemic was mishandled by the Obama administration. 1,000 people died before they did anything of any substance. And President Trump acted much more quickly, much more decisively. He actually came through, and he's been coming through. And the Democrats have been lying about his work ever since he started. Remember, they called him a racist. They said he was a xenophobe. Joe Biden called his closure of travel from China racist and xenophobic. He basically insinuated that the man was insane for doing what he did. And then the World Health Organization, which we can spend an entire podcast about how inept those people are, they finally said, yeah, that was a good move. As a result of President Trump's actions, specifically his actions when the Democrats were trying to impeach him, as a result of his actions, thousands upon thousands of people in America are alive today who may have passed away from the coronavirus. And yet his political opposition will continue to lie. They will continue to mislead. They will continue to attempt to destroy him in order to have power and control over this nation once again. And they can never be allowed to have that power and control ever in the future of this country if you value your liberty and your freedom. Hey, that's it. God bless you. Have a good day. We'll see you back here tomorrow for the Friday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.